Hello, I'm George Walker, and this is WFIU's Profiles. Our guest is Bill Ivey. Bill Ivey is the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, and he's in town for the rededication of the IU Auditorium. Bill, thanks very, very much for coming.
It's good to be here.
I was thinking that it's been a long time since I've seen you back in Bloomington. I first encountered you at the University of Michigan in the late 50s, early 60s. And at that time, I wanted to take guitar lessons from you. You were a hot folk guitar player. I came down here, and son of a gun, I found you at Indiana University and asked you, and you still didn't have enough time. Are you busy a little later this afternoon?
George, I'm sorry. I still don't have the time. But I don't know if I was ever a hot player. I think I was more of a warm to lukewarm player. But it coming back to not only the Indiana campus, but to this very station brings back a lot of memories.
Bill, you were a high school student in Michigan, then you went to the Yes. University of Michigan, came down to graduate school at Indiana University. So your background really in school, at least, is from two of the big public universities.
Yes.
A little different than perhaps some of the other people that you run into around Washington.
Well, it's interesting when you become part of an administration and spend time in Washington, you do realize that the private schools of the Northeast have, I wouldn't say a death grip, but a grip on our federal government. And you do find a lot of people who come through that part of the educational system.
Bill, as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, you brought a lot of things to the table and to the process by which you were confirmed. I've always thought that the committees were particularly interested in the kind of background and the experiences that you brought. Your background in music and your background with really for-profit sector.
I think both of those things were of interest. And in addition, I think the fact that my time as the director of a not-for-profit cultural organization was spent with the Country Music Foundation, running the Country Music Hall of Fame, research library of that institution. And I think that connection with grassroots popular music, a kind of popular music that's very well grounded in folk tradition, was intriguing to first the administration, to the president, members of the administration, and then as I met with members of Congress going through my confirmation process, I think it was of interest to them too. I've felt, given my training here on the IU campus in folklore, and then my subsequent experience as director of the Country Music Foundation, the two combined to give me a good starting point for thinking about and talking about the nature of American cultural life, the nature of America's artistic life. And I think that grassroots grounding has played very well with Congress, that I think has felt from time to time that the arts presented themselves as something that's very, very elite, that only has to do with the sophisticated arts of Europe and really doesn't connect as well as, say, Congress might like with the mainstream of the American experience. So I think I brought some of those elements into play, and I think it's helped me and I think helped the agency make some strides in the last couple of years.
In a recent speech, you said that you thought that artists and arts administrators could actually make an argument that that arts were more important than national defense.
Well, I've said that in a couple of speeches, and I always say that with a quick following disclaimer that I'm not talking about, say, the level of funding that the Department of Defense enjoys, because I think that's something that's unattainable for culture in this society. But I am trying to make the point that culture and the nurturing of America's cultural life constitutes a kind of internal defense that helps to keep our sense of unity, our sense of being one people, even though we are made up of so many different cultures and artistic traditions. And I make the case over and over that America as a creative society, America that has a rich cultural tradition, really must spend some small part of its collective resources nurturing that creativity and nurturing our nation's living cultural heritage. So what I would like to accomplish in my time as chairman of the NEA, among other things, but I think one important goal is to try to help the agency move the arts and the sense of the value of a government investment in the arts from the margins of what we're all about in the society, closer to the center of community and family life. And so when I talk about comparing the arts endowment with the Department of Defense, I'm really trying to say that we haven't come to grips with our creative character. We haven't really pulled together all of the multiple streams of our cultural traditions into a single sense of who we are as a nation, and that if we spend some time and some money accomplishing that task, I think we can make the nation better and stronger and have some of the effect of increasing our national security that the Department of Defense actually has.
We're talking with Bill Ivey. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Bill, as you went to elementary school and junior high and high school in Michigan, what do you think about the contact that you had in the arts through school and through the community?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly something that the Arts Endowment today is interested in is bringing art back into schools the way art had a presence in the schools 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And I can remember from my time in grade school, we had a piano in just about every classroom. I had either a music teacher who came into the classroom for a period of time every day or a teacher who could also teach music along with math and reading. I had drawing classes, both as part of my grade school and then available to me as a high school student. And in high school, there were dramas and a chorus and a band. And I think we have seen those kinds of experiences eased out of the public schools over the last 25 or 30 years, perhaps in that post-Sputnik era in which so much emphasis came to be placed on the teaching of science and technology, math, and, of course, reading. And also as schools and school systems came under budgetary pressures, it became easy to see the arts somehow as being on the margins and therefore dispensable. And I think we saw a lot of the arts move out of the school system. And so young people today in many parts of the country don't have the kind of experiences that were available to me in school in the 1950s. I was also blessed by a family that cared about art and music, so that when I was not in school and was at home, my mother was playing the piano and we were always singing and listening to records and reading books and talking about literature. And so in my home life, there was a sense that expressive life, that creativity and that cultural heritage were very much a part of what family and community life were all about. And I think that in a society like ours, with the kinds of financial resources that we have, we should find a way, both in school and out of school, to make culture as important a part of Americans' lives as culture deserves to be. So my experiences, I think, were certainly formative, and also I think perhaps experiences that in character are not as available to young people today as they should be. And certainly our society, though simpler then, was not a richer society. I think we simply had a more rounded sense of what constituted a complete education. My sense today is that the pendulum is swinging back in that direction, and that we're beginning to see the relationships between art and other disciplines in school, and we're seeing the value of having young people who have access to these experiences during and after school, seeing the importance of that kind of cultural activity. So I think part of my job as NEA chairman is to keep trying to push the pendulum in that direction as far as possible, so that maybe we can, you know, somehow even get back to the kind of era, you know, of say the late 19th century, when if you were part of an educated family, in an educated family, the young people could play a musical instrument, sing a song, recite a poem, draw a picture, write a good letter, write an essay. I think it's not too much to expect in a society with the resources that we have today for those same kind of experiences and those same kind of creative skills to be part of the arsenal of every young person who leaves school and leaves the family and goes out into the world.
At the same time that the riches that you describe existed for students in public school, I think many young people in the late 50s and early 60s felt in some ways cut off from the popular culture. For many people, we felt that people in their 30s and 40s were making the music that was supposed to be ours, and we were looking for some connections. And I understand that around this time is when perhaps you took up the guitar.
Well, I was struck by lightning, as by lightning, by the Kingston Trio's recording of Tom Dooley. And it seemed to me, when I first heard it, and I think it became a hit in 1958, and I was, I guess, in the eighth grade thereabouts, and all of a sudden I realized that there was something different, very different in character from the, say, the sing-along with Mitch standards that were popular in other settings, and that there was a kind of music that was grounded in a different place. I learned later it was grounded in community and in historical continuity. I think it set me off in a direction that really has dictated much of my academic and professional life, the love of that kind of folk-based music, and then the love of the instruments that surround it. I tried to learn to play the guitar, had a little book with pictures, kind of line drawings of a guy in a tuxedo, you know, how to hold the plectrum, those kinds of instructions I couldn't learn from that book. And I actually sold my first guitar to a friend in northern Michigan, and he turned around and taught me to play it. And then my poor parents had to go out and buy me another one. After that one false start, the guitar became an important part of my life, and I played in bands and was a teacher of the guitar. And while I consider myself now to be, I guess, what you would call an artist citizen rather than a real artist, I think it's great to have that kind of amateur activity as a part of your life. And in fact, it's a privilege to be able to play an instrument but not have to play it for a living.
Throughout history, there have been many songs written about the Eternal Triangle. This next one tells the story of a Mr. Grayson, a beautiful woman, and a condemned man named Tom Dooley. When the sun rises tomorrow, Tom Dooley must hang. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die. I met her on the mountain. There I took her life. Met her on the mountain.
We're talking with Bill Ivey. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Bill, when you went to college, to the University of Michigan, I know you continued to play guitar, but I think you also were involved in a number of cultural things. Were you bitten by the science bug at that point also a bit?
Just a bit, but in a way, science, in an indirect way, caused me to move even closer to a study of traditional culture than I ever had been, because I was on a program at the University of Michigan that required that I have kind of a science minor. I had to take physics and chemistry, and I really struggled with those courses. And what it caused me to do is to get out of that program and move me closer toward a study of the humanities through a degree in history and then into the Folklore Institute here at Indiana that is now the Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. So the part of science that fascinated me was the science of sound. And I became something of an amateur recordist, and as a fan of bluegrass music, became a frequent taper of of live performances, and a few of those have actually been released on commercial record years after I first made the tapes. So that was the part of science that really grabbed me, the part that supported the way the electric guitar worked, the way a tape recorder worked, the way a sound system worked, or the way things worked in a recording studio.
While you were a history major at the University of Michigan, I believe you also did some writing.
I did. I think I've had an off and on flirtation, a somewhat illusory flirtation, you know, with the writing of fiction. And I did a little bit of work as an undergraduate, and actually was fortunate to win one of the minor literary prizes on that campus. There's a very famous prize that's given at the University of Michigan for writing called the Hopwood Award. I won a Hopwood, I guess, the summer of 1966, which was the summer that I was wrapping up my work at Michigan. And maybe that was more encouragement than I deserved, because a number of years later, I went to a fiction writing workshop up at Skidmore College in upstate New York, and spent a good bit of a summer working on my fiction, and really decided that while there was just the hint of a spark of talent, I didn't have the time, nor did I have the discipline, to develop the craft the way one really must if anyone is going to set out to be a writer. So my interest in writing ultimately taught me just how difficult that work really is. And in fact, to me, that's one of the great advantages, one of the great benefits of being an amateur at something. It teaches you just how hard it is to be a professional. 4 or 5 years ago, I started taking piano lessons. I'll never be a pianist, but I listen to the piano and appreciate the work of great pianists much better than I did before I studied the instrument. And the same is true of my relationship with the guitar and with creative writing. When you stumble around with something, it still, even though you may not become a professional, I think it makes you a part of the work of the real professional. And I think that's a great reason for engaging in that kind of activity.
Earlier, you talked about the richness of your own family's involvement with the arts, and to some degree, this was a situation at Michigan where your father actually followed you.
That was a very unusual circumstance. My dad worked at many jobs during his lifetime, and I guess when he was in his early 30s, he decided that what he really wanted to do was obtain what he had never obtained, which is a college degree. And so he actually started at the University of Michigan when I was in the sixth or seventh grade. And for 1 year, he commuted from far northern Michigan down to Ann Arbor. Later, the family moved with him, and we would trek down to the vicinity of Ann Arbor every fall and then move back up to northern Michigan for the summers. And he left the campus without quite finishing his degree, but worked on a few courses he hadn't completed on other campuses, I think on campus of Northern Michigan University. And it ended up that actually he beat me by a year. He is the class of 1965, and I'm the class of 66. And it was interesting. When he passed away about 5 years ago, the Hopwood newsletter, which was the newsletter of those who had won that literary Hopwood Prize, spotted his death and ran an obituary for me.
We're talking with Bill Ivey. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts and our guest on Profile here on WFIU. Bill, when you finished up at the University of Michigan, you looked southward and headed down toward Indiana University. Why did you come to IU for graduate school? What were you looking for?
Well, there was a magnetic pull here, and it was the Folklore Institute. I had been studying history at the University of Michigan, but worked as a guitar teacher at a legendary institution in Ann Arbor called the Herb David Guitar Studio. It's still there. I wanted to find a way to convert my interest in traditional culture and in traditional music into a line of study and perhaps even a line of work. And I heard about the existence of the Folk Art Institute, and there were at that time precious few places in the United States where you could study folklore. And I wrote to the Institute, and Richard Dorson, who was then the director of the Institute, took an interest in me as a student because he had done some of his earliest research in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where I grew up. And Dorson encouraged me to come down to Indiana, and so I came right out of my undergraduate time at Michigan and began my work here at Indiana in the fall of 1996. And it was a wonderful experience. I ended up working in late in my career here on the IU campus with Dorson, but at first I worked more closely with ethnomusicologists, people like George List, and learned a great deal. And then late in my time here, in addition to working with the Folklore Institute, I studied in the Department of History in my doctoral program, working on a double minor in history, and had a chance to work with people like Martin Riggs and Bernard Sheehan, some really wonderful teachers. And when I look back on that time from the perspective of today, of being the chairman of the Arts Endowment, I realize that the way in which I talk about American culture, the way in which I talk about the way art connects with culture and society, those ways of thinking come directly from what I learned here at Indiana working with six or eight wonderful teachers. So I had a good time while I was here, and now when I look back on it, I realize that it was also an extraordinarily valuable time to me in terms of shaping my career and my thinking.
I know that you were snatched up by the graduate student bluegrass band, the Pigeon Hill Boys.
The Pigeon Hill Boys. Snatched up is as generous as hot guitar player. But I'll go along with it for purposes of our discussion.
It was an interesting group. It was folklore students. It was some people from the town.
Yes.
There was a fellow who worked for the Bloomington Herald Times who played guitar and sang. There was a fellow who now is a professor in Canada of folklore.
And, right.
And his wife played bass.
Right.
And I believe that they actually transformed you into a mandolin player for that group.
Yes, because, the rule was set by Bill Monroe. You know, the question in bluegrass is, why do tenor singers always play the mandolin? And, of course, it's because Bill Monroe is the great tenor singer, and he played mandolin. I sang tenor. There are always too many guitar players, no matter what you do around bluegrass. There seems to be one guitar player too many. So I was encouraged to take up the mandolin. And I never was very accomplished on it, but I could get by, play a few simple solos and play rhythm chords on the mandolin, and in that way kind of round out the sound. But the Pigeon Hill Boys were, as you described them, a kind of, it was a name without fixed personnel. And so from year to year, as the composition of university departments on this campus ebbed and flowed, you'd find different people coming in under that Pigeon Hill Boys name and working in the band. So I was in it for a couple of years.
If you were going to pick a couple of bluegrass tunes as things that you particularly enjoyed, what might those be?
Well, it's tough, but I would say, you know, you've got to think about Bill Monroe as a great master, and I would say something like a tune like Muleskinner Blues would be a great example of a Bill Monroe standard.
How about Blue Moon of Kentucky?
That's another wonderful Monroe tune. It's hard to choose between the slower songs that have a lot of what you might call hillbilly heart and the more up-tempo, hard-driving tunes that are really characteristic of bluegrass. And, you know, you can move through the great bands of the 40s and 50s. The Stanley Brothers did some wonderful things. Certainly Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, Earl's banjo playing on a tune like Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Those are some of the performances that I think, set standards for bluegrass musicians right up until today. As Ricky Skaggs comes back into bluegrass, you still hear the bluegrass artists invoking the repertory and the sound of bands like Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys and Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs.
Do you need another mule skinner? With a black stag with two tongues. How, how? What a day.
We've been talking with Bill Ivey. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Bill, while you were at Indiana University, you actually did a program for WFIU.
I did. I ended up doing two programs.
Well, right. But let's talk about the first one
first. Which one was it, George?
I'm not sure.
I think it was called Our Singing Heritage. And it was a folk music show that was somewhat like, when I think back on it, somewhat like the Pigeon Hill Boys, in that it was a show that WFIU had in its schedule, and it was hosted by different, generally different graduate students in the Folklore Institute, and you'd host for a year or two or three, and then it would be handed off to someone else. And I started it with a colleague of mine named Elliot Oring, and Elliot and I did that show together for, I guess, a year and a half or 2 years, and we couldn't agree, believe it or not. We had kind of classic show business arguments, and he finally left me to go my own way. So then I hosted the show by myself for a couple of years.
I think you actually changed the name. I think it may have started
out right.
That and then took on a bit of a late 60s guise under the name The Folk Scene.
The Folk Scene, that's right. That's right. It was Our Singing Heritage, and then it became The Folk Scene.
Now, with a background that both had started in some ways with the excitement of a college band, the Kingston Trio, and then moved to a deeper exploration, what kinds of things were you trying to do for the audience as you explored things on that show at WFIU?
Well, I think that the show, when I was hosting it, concentrated on the Anglo-American and African-American folk music traditions. And what I was always interested in demonstrating was, and I think it's something that still interests me a great deal, is to show to an audience that beneath many popular performances, things that can be hits, you can find authentic performers, those who are really grounded in community and are really part of a tradition, who are the ultimate resource. And so a good number of the folk music shows tried to make connections that might surprise the audience a little bit. You may have heard X, but doesn't it surprise you that the music that's behind it is really Y? And to show that behind a song like, you know, Tom Dooley, that the Kingston Trio had such a hit with, there's, you know, an old-time musician named Clarence Ashley who performs that song at a very fast tempo, accompanying on the banjo, and that's the real source of what was ultimately rearranged into the pop hit. So that was one of the kinds of connections, to kind of take an audience that might have a sense of what American folk music is like and increase the depth of the understanding a little bit.
At the same time that you were working with that show, you went to the powers that were at WFIU and proposed an offshoot. You felt that with the kinds of tools that you had and the background that you had, that American popular music really could be presented in an interesting way on a public radio station that played a lot of classical music. And so you spun off a show called The Pop Scene.
Yes. And that show, I'm a little embarrassed to think back on it because it was a good idea, but I think that it revealed ultimately the lack of breadth of my knowledge of popular music. And I kept coming back to certain themes, connections between pop and folk, introducing genres that the WFIU audience might not be familiar with, so spending a little time on blues, spending a little time on country music and on bluegrass, and talking in pedantic a way, talking about the characteristics of different musical styles. And if I had it to do over again, I think I'd be more aggressive about seeking out new music and making sure that the show had access to a breadth of newly released material. I think that was a challenge. With the folk show, between my own record collection and those of friends, we could get just about anything we needed. FIU's pop library was pretty small, between small and non-existent, and my own library existed but was a little narrow. So I think the pop sound, I think it had good intent, but never quite achieved what I would have liked it to achieve.
We really should mention the fact that while you were at IU, in addition to studying history, ethnomusicology, folklore, you also were spending a fair amount of time in the music school with the jazz players.
Yes, and it was probably more time spent admiring their work than actually playing jazz. But I did spend some time with Gary Potter, who's a good bass player, and with David Baker, who was already something of a legend on campus, but was still, I think, cementing his role as a composer and a band leader and an educator. You know, I did something that I would certainly encourage any student to do when I was a graduate student, which is I took courses outside of my basic area of study. So while I was taking courses in folklore, ethnomusicology, and history, I also took courses in radio and television production and studied theory in the School of Music. Those excursions outside of my major were very helpful to me. I get the sense today that students feel such a great sense of urgency to make their learning experience on a campus very efficient, to move it through to into a career that they wouldn't get into those kinds of side trips. And I found those to be extraordinarily satisfying at the time. And in retrospect, they were also very helpful to me because when I did leave the Indiana campus, I got into a line of work, working with an organization in which a knowledge of things like music theory and radio and television production became really helpful.
So the words exploratory and undecided are not necessarily things that you think are a bad thing for a college freshman to
I think they're not. And, of course, I was still doing it when I was, you know, 3 years into graduate school. But I think it was had some value even at that late date.
Talking with Bill Ivey, he's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Bill, when you were working with David Baker and Gary Potter and some of the people in the Jazz Institute at IU, the jazz faculty, what things were you listening to then? Who were the artists that particularly interested you? Were you still following guitar players or become enamored of the horns?
Well, because I was a guitar player, I've always had a real soft spot in my heart for that instrument and some of the real innovators on it. I'm a big fan of a guitarist who passed away not that many years ago, Joe Pass, the pioneer of the seven-string guitar, George Van Epps, is a great player. The trumpeter-turned-guitarist, Johnny Smith, I think is quite a fascinating player who brought an outstanding technique to the instrument and a terrific grasp of theory. And those are players who I started to listen to when I was in graduate school, and in fact, I still listen to some of those very instrumentalist today. I was in New York and happened into the big Tower Records there and bought Johnny Smith a CD, and that interest continues. Again, I think studying these instruments helps you appreciate those who can really play them well, and there's value in pursuing that kind of learning, even if you don't even have the goal of ultimately being able to master the instrument. But guitar has kind of been my thing, and even though I have many limitations as a player, it certainly has been a window into an appreciation for some of the great masters of the instrument. Thank you.
We've been talking with Bill Ivey. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Bill, after you left Indiana University, 4 years of undergrad, three or so of graduate school, I think at that point in your life, the thought of anything longer than a couple of years seems like it must be forever. But the next item on your list goes from 1971 to 1998.
It was a long job that I thought was going to be almost temporary. I was looking for a teaching job in the spring and summer of 1971, and it was a very tough time to get any kind of a position in the humanities. And, you know, here I was a folklorist, not yet finished my doctoral dissertation, out looking for a teaching job with a double minor in history. And it really was not a highly marketable combination then, probably still isn't today, that famous folklore history combination. And so there just weren't jobs out there. And a friend of mine, a guy named Doug Green, who now has a band called Riders in the Sky, a cowboy band, I'd known him at the University of Michigan. We'd both worked at the Herb David Guitar Studio. And Doug told me about a job at the Country Music Hall of Fame running the library. And I had been the cataloger at the Archives of Traditional Music here at Indiana. And so I wrote about the job. And they wrote back and interviewed me and offered me that job running the library at the Country Music Foundation. A few months later, they made me director of the overall organization, which was very tiny at the time. It had three or four employees, a little 4,000-square-foot museum, a library that was really a library in name only, didn't have much of a collection. I was able to work with that organization for a quarter of a century and help to really grow both the museum and the library components of that not for profit, and it was a wonderful job. I could work in the museum field. I worked in the library field. We started a record label. Had a small book publishing program with Vanderbilt University. Now that institution is about to, I think within the next 12 or 14 months, is about to move into a brand new facility in downtown Nashville. So the foundation has done very, very well, but it was my opportunity to work in a not-for-profit setting, in a cultural organization, where we were really trying to preserve the history of an art form, country music, and presented to an audience in an intellectually credible fashion, and also simultaneously to work closely with an aspect of the entertainment community, with the leadership of the country music industry. So it opened up a number of great doors for me. I spent some time as the chairman of the board of the Recording Academy, the people who give the Grammy Awards, and so that connected me with the Los Angeles popular music scene. So it was easy, in a sense, to stay there for 25-plus years because there was so much variety built into the job, and at least for the first 20 years, there was so much growth built into the situation that it was almost as though every two or three years, the job transformed itself. While now I think it was time for me to leave, move on and do something else when I left a couple of years ago, it was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity and a great way to use a university degree that might have been intended for teaching but is also good for many other things.
So there you got to do – you did some production. You got to work with tools as a researcher.
Yes.
Probably did some writing.
Did some writing.
Those kinds of jobs.
Yes.
So it really did use just many of the tools and in a way many of the attitudes – that you'd been working with.
It offered exactly that kind of experience. And I think late in my career as a graduate student, I took a colloquium with a professor named Thomas Clark. He was a Southern historian. I think he'd undergone mandatory retirement at the University of Kentucky and had been snatched up by Indiana to come in here and write a history of the university. But he was teaching this one course. And one of the things that Professor Clark brought to my attention that no one had before was that an advanced degree in the humanities is not just, it's not a teaching certificate. It's really a tool that you can use in many different environments. And he talked about his former students who were federal judges and or who were heads of corporations. And I suddenly realized when I listened to Tom Clark talk that that training in folklore, training in history, could be something that you would move into different sectors. It wasn't just a path into a university teaching job. And so I think with having had that course with him and having heard him talk about that aspect of higher education, when the Country Music Foundation opportunity came along and I could leave the academy and go into the not-for-profit world, which is really only a half step away from the university life, I took the opportunity eagerly. And it turned out to be a wonderful choice for me. I think that temperamentally I'm better suited to working in a corporate environment than, say, a university teaching environment. So I think that's another reason why it was easy to take on those responsibilities with the Country Music Hall of Fame and stay there for all those years.
We're talking with Bill Ivey. He was the head of the Country Music Hall of Fame from 1971 to 1998. He's now the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Bill, while you were at the Country Music Hall of Fame, you began to appear on various boards and committees and began to work really with the NEA very closely, preparing yourself perhaps in some ways for the call when it came in hindsight. What sorts of attitudes and what sorts of thoughts do you think worked that eventually really made this make sense?
I think that's a good question, and no one has asked me that yet in the time that I've been chairman. I think there were two or three ideas that ran on parallel tracks. One was that early on, when I first started work as an NEA panelist in the late 1970s, I developed a real affection for the agency. I felt that it was doing important work, and there existed in the halls of the NEA offices a wonderful sense of mission and a real sense of the value of America's cultural heritage. And so I cared a lot about the NEA. I think I simultaneously was a little critical of the agency because I felt, from my perspective as a folklorist and an Americanist who'd studied American history and folklore, that the agency perhaps wasn't as grounded in the American experience as it might have been. It had really been born out of the needs of the great arts organizations of the big cities, opera companies and dance companies and symphony orchestras, who were struggling in the late 50s and early 1960s. But I think it accepted too easily a kind of hierarchical view of the organization of American culture that probably didn't bode well for its long-term ease. And so I was a little critical of the agency, but also felt that it had a great heart and great purpose. So I was, without any intent, I think, laying the groundwork to ultimately become chairman. And through the good offices of a friend of mine who works with the Clinton administration, I had become a member of something called the President's Committee in the Arts and the Humanities, which is a separate entity that works on public-private partnerships around arts issues and conducts some research on arts issues. And my presence on that committee, I think, allowed me to audition a little bit in front of the Clinton administration. I worked on a report for the President's Committee called Creative America. I was one of the principal authors of it. So in early 1997, I think it was January or February of 1997, when Jane Alexander let the president know that she didn't want a second term as chairman, my name surfaced as a possible candidate almost right away. And over a very convoluted process, my name finally leaked out as the candidate, I guess, in late November of that same year of 1997. And then, again, through a fairly complicated process that is better heard about than experienced, I was finally confirmed by the Senate in May of 1998, which is actually fairly quick. So it was interesting, without ever seeking the job, actually at a time when the Country Music Foundation was about to undergo a great expansion, that the CMF was in the middle of a capital campaign to build this new building. I suddenly had the opportunity to leave and go to Washington, do something that was related to what I had done but was still very, very different. And as in the case of taking the job in Nashville back in 1971, though there are many challenges around the NEA, I haven't regretted the move for a second. It's been a great experience, a learning experience, very rewarding.
We've been talking with Bill Ivey. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's in Bloomington for the rededication of the IU Auditorium. And I'm George Walker for WFIU's Profiles. Shine on the moon that's gone and let me blue. I say blue moon of Kentucky to keep on shining. Shine on the moon that's gone and let me blue. Well, the heat was on one moonlight night. Stars shining bright. Whisper on high, love, say goodbye. Blue moon of Kentucky to keep on shining. Shine on the moon that's gone and let me blue.
The program you just heard was produced in the studios of WFIU in January of 2000. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Pazcash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.